Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 8, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the main headline reads, Israel says forces in depths of Gaza City. Netanyahu says his country will take over, quote, security responsibility, close quote. Israel said Tuesday that its ground forces were battling Hamas fighters deep inside Gaza's largest city, signaling a major new stage in the month-old conflict, and its leaders foresee controlling the enclave's security after the war. The push into Gaza City guarantees the already staggering death toll will rise further, while comments from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about controlling Gaza's security for, quote, an indefinite period, close quote, pointed to an uncertain endgame for a war that Israel says will be long and difficult. Israeli ground troops battled Palestinian militants inside Gaza for over a week, cutting the territory in half and encircling Gaza City. The Army's chief spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said Israeli ground forces are located right now in a ground operation in the depths of Gaza City and putting great pressure on Hamas. Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad, speaking on Tuesday from Beirut, denied that Israel forces made significant military gains or that they advanced deep into Gaza City. They never give people the truth. Hamad said the Palestinians fight and fight and fight against Israel until we end the occupation, said Hamad, who left Gaza days before the attack. The Associated Press could not independently verify the claims of either side. Israelis commemorated the 30th day, a milestone in Jewish mourning, since Hamas militants killed 1,400 people during an October 7 rampage in southern Israel that sparked the war. Some 240 people Hamas abducted during the attack remain in Gaza, and more than 250,000 Israelis evacuated homes near the borders of Gaza and Lebanon amid continuous rockets fired into Israel. A month of relentless bombardment in Gaza has killed more than 10,300 Palestinians, two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry of the Hamas-run territory. More than 2,300 are believed buried from strikes that reduced entire city blocks to rubble. Israel unleashed another wave of strikes across the Gaza Strip on Tuesday as hundreds more Palestinians fled Gaza City to the south. Hundreds of thousands heeded Israeli orders to head to the southern part of Gaza, out of the ground assault's path. Others are afraid to do so, since Israeli troops control part of the north-south route. Bob Marmot of the South also continued. An Israeli airstrike destroyed several homes early Tuesday in Khan Yunis. An Associated Press journalist at the scene saw first responders pulling five bodies, including three dead children, from the rubble. We were sleeping, babies, children, elderly, said one survivor, Ahmad Al-Najjar, who is the general director at the Education Ministry in Gaza. In the town of Deir al-Balah, rescue workers brought out at least four dead and a number of wounded children from the wreckage of a flattened building, witnesses said. Israel claims it targets Hamas fighters and infrastructure and accuses the group of endangering civilians by operating among them. Israel has vowed to remove Hamas from power and crush its military capabilities, but neither Israel nor its main ally, the United States, said what would come next. Netanyahu told ABC News that Gaza should be governed by those who don't want to continue the way of Hamas, without elaborating. I think Israel will, for an indefinite period, will have the overall security responsibility, because we've seen what happens when we don't have it, he said. When we don't have that security responsibility, What we have is the eruption of Hamas terror on a scale that we couldn't imagine. Netanyahu did not make clear what shape that security control would take. The White House on Tuesday reiterated that President Joe Biden does not support an Israeli reoccupation of the Gaza Strip after the war. We do think that there needs to be a healthy set of conversations about what post-conflict Gaza looks like and what governance looks like, said White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. Israeli officials acknowledge they have not yet formulated a concrete plan for what comes after the war. The defense minister has said Israel does not seek a long-term reoccupation of Gaza, but predicted a lengthy phase of low-intensity fighting against pockets of resistance. Other officials have spoken about establishing a buffer zone that would keep Palestinians away from the Israeli border. There are a number of options being discussed for the day after Hamas, said Ophir Falk, a senior advisor to Netanyahu. The common denominator of all the plans is that 1) there is no Hamas, 2) that Gaza is demilitarized, 3) Gaza is de-radicalized. Israel withdrew troops and settlers in 2005, but kept control over Gaza's airspace, coastline, population registry, and border crossings, excepting one into Egypt. Hamas seized power from forces loyal to President Mahmoud Abbas in 2007, confining his Palestinian Authority to parts of the occupied West Bank. Since then, Israel and Egypt imposed a blockade on Gaza to varying degrees. In his ABC interview, Netanyahu also expressed openness for the first time to, quote, little pauses, close quote, in the fighting to facilitate delivery of aid to Gaza or the release of hostages, but he ruled out any general ceasefire without the release of all the hostages. Also on the front page, an article entitled UAW Endorsement of Biden for President Still Unsure. President Joe Biden called the head of the United Auto Workers Union to congratulate him on getting a new contract with General Motors and to wish him a happy 55th birthday, a sign of how the relationship had evolved since their first get-to-know-you meeting in the Oval Office on July 19. UAW President Sean Fain launched the strike against GM, Ford, and Chrysler-owned Stellantis with a willingness to force political leaders to choose between backing unions or corporations. Biden had long straddled this line. He proclaimed in speeches that unions built the middle class, but he also heralded his credentials as a former senator from the corporate capital of the world, also known as Delaware. The White House was determined to build trust with Fain and look past his occasional slights of Biden. That approach, which included Biden meeting with workers on the picket line in Michigan, helped to resolve the nearly 45-day set of strikes and produced significant pay raises for workers. But even as Biden's sympathies publicly shifted toward union workers during the standoff, there are few signs that the UAW fully warmed to the Democratic president. Biden has yet to receive the union's endorsement as he seeks re-election with the message that he has delivered for blue-collar workers. The UAW declined to talk about its relationship with the White House. No final decision on the endorsement is expected to come until after contracts with the automakers are finalized, which probably will happen later this month. The relationship between Fain and Biden could be crucial to the outcome of the 2024 election. More than 380,000 UAW members are scattered in states that include Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, places where narrow margins have decided the overall winner of the past two presidential contests. Jean Sperling, the White House liaison for the strike talks, was in daily contact with executives at the UAW and the three automakers. Biden tasked the economic advisor, who has served in three Democratic White Houses, to develop a bond with the UAW, but also preserve connections with the automakers that are helping to deliver on Biden's electric vehicle agenda. Sperling said he followed a set of principles in communicating with all sides. We're not here to intervene. We're not here to mediate, but we want to be in touch. We want to be helpful. As the week stretched on, though, Biden and his team did less straddling and publicly stepped ever closer to the union. At one point, Sperling stressed to the automakers the UAW's position that new contracts needed a built-in cost of living adjustment so that wages could be adjusted for inflation. That adjustment became part of the tentative agreement, which for GM workers also includes a 30% pay bump through April 2028, when the contract would expire. Biden staked out his position that the auto workers had made sacrifices during the 2008 financial crisis to keep their employers afloat. Now that automakers were pulling in billions of dollars in profits, the president said those same workers should share in the rewards. The politics were thorny, as the president has suffered from low ratings on his economic leadership. U.S. adults have largely overlooked the healthy 3.9% unemployment rate to focus instead on inflation, including the 20% jump in new vehicle prices since he became president. But union households have also been a decisive constituency for Democrats. They represent only 16% of voters nationwide, but Biden won the group by a solid 56% in 2020, according to AP VoteCast, a national survey of the electorate. While organized labor has overwhelmingly backed Biden, the UAW remains a key holdout. Fain has criticized Donald Trump, the front-runner for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, yet in the weeks leading to the strike and afterward, the labor leader could be out of sync at times with Biden. When Fain went to the White House on July 19 to meet with senior officials, Biden insisted on a 30-minute meeting in the Oval Office without aides, Sperling said. But Labor Day showed cracks in relations between the union and the White House. Asked by reporters about prospects for a strike that had yet to be declared, Biden tried to play down the risk. I'm not worried about a strike until it happens, Biden said on September 4. I don't think it's going to happen. Fain responded to a separate group of reporters by suggesting that Biden was misguided. He must know something we don't know. Maybe the companies plan on walking in and giving us our demands on the night before. I don't know. But he's on the inside on something I don't know about. Biden's September 26 visit to a Michigan picket line, a presidential first, garnered praise from Fain, but little else. Fain said that Biden has chosen to stand up with workers and added that we know the president will do right by the working class and when we do right by the working class. But the UAW president declined to endorse the president, who had engaged in the historic outreach. We'll just see how things proceed, Fain said at the time. That's up not just to me, it's up to our leadership and our membership, and we have our process we follow. So, as I said, we'll do that when it's time. On page 2, we find an article entitled WeWork Seeks Bankruptcy Protection. WeWork filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, marking a stunning fall for the office-sharing company, once seen as a Wall Street darling that promised to spin upend the way people went to work around the world. The New York company said late Monday it entered into a restructuring agreement with most of its stakeholders aimed at slashing its debt, while it looks to trim its commercial office lease portfolio. The agreement is expected to erase about $3 billion of WeWork's debt, CEO David Talley told the Associated Press. WeWork is paying the price for aggressive expansion in its early years. The company went public in October 2021 after its first attempt to do so 2 years earlier collapsed spectacularly. The debacle led to the ouster of founder and CEO Adam Neumann, whose erratic behavior and exorbitant spending spooked early investors. I feel like WeWork has been imploding in slow motion, Nicole Schmidt, an attorney and managing partner at investment banking firm Oberon Securities, said while pointing to Neumann's actions that led up to the company's first IPO failing. WeWork as a company may survive, but they've got a tremendous amount of baggage, she added. The new management team has to prove that they're good operators. The specter of bankruptcy has hovered over WeWork for some time. Shortly after sounding the alarm over its business prospects this summer, the company announced plans to renegotiate nearly all of its leases in September. But cracks began to emerge several years ago, not long after the company was valued as high as $47 billion. Japan's SoftBank stepped in to keep WeWork afloat, acquiring majority control over the company. WeWork shareholders are largely wiped out, though SoftBank, which owns nearly 80% of the equity distributed in the company, is likely still in negotiations after losing billions of dollars. Despite efforts to turn the company around since Neumann's departure, including significant cuts to operating costs and rising revenue, WeWork struggled in a commercial real estate market rocked by the rising cost of borrowing money, as well as a shifting dynamic for millions of office workers now checking into work remotely. Its bankruptcy filing arrives at a time of incredible disruption in the commercial real estate market. The COVID-19 pandemic led to a spike in vacancies, and major markets, from New York to San Francisco, are still struggling. On a market-by-market and on a building level, landlords with exposure to WeWork could take significant hits if their leases are terminated. There's also rising competition in the flexible office industry, and that includes some legacy office landlords competing directly with co-working space providers today, said Sam Shandon, director of the Chow Han Chen Institute for Global Real Estate Finance at New York University's Stern School of Business. Still, it's important to separate WeWork's current situation with the future of various co-working models as a whole, he notes, again pointing to the company's rapid expansion in its early years. As part of its bankruptcy filing, WeWork is also seeking to reject leases for some of its locations, which the company says are largely non-operational. Just over 70 leases will be rejected at the beginning of the process, according to Monday's filing. WeWork said all of its affected members received advanced notice. How many WeWork locations will remain open going forward is not known. The company said it plans to stay in the vast majority of its current markets. Lease liabilities, which account for about two-thirds of WeWork's operating costs, continue to be the company's primary challenge, Tolley said. The company still has 500,000 members. While the full impact of this week's bankruptcy filing is still uncertain, WeWork sounded an optimistic note. In a year, we're going to be right where we are today. We are open for business for 500,000 people all around the world, Talley said. The only difference is a year from now, the company will be profitable in a way it just has never gotten to in the past. In Monday's filing, WeWork listed about $18.7 billion in debts and $15.1 billion in assets as of June 30. In its most recent filing, that includes figures WeWork operated 777 locations in 39 countries. In national and world news, we find an article entitled, Another Closure Looms. Days before pending shutdown, lawmakers focus on other funding. 10 days before a potential government shutdown, Congress is no closer to resolving the standoff and is even complicating the issue with Republican demands for border security changes as a condition for further support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. New House Speaker Mike Johnson said Tuesday that Republicans don't want to close things down, but he's well aware that his predecessor, Representative Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, was ousted as Speaker after compromising with Democrats in September to keep federal offices opening. We certainly want to avoid a government shutdown, Johnson said in a news conference. It's a dangerous time around the world right now, he said. We recognize that, and we're doing our job. Johnson faces one of his most difficult tests yet. Just 2 weeks on the job, he won after McCarthy's ouster. Rather than lead the House Republicans into a strategy, the Louisiana Republican appears to be crowdsourcing a way out of the government funding dilemma with his GOP colleagues. At a closed-door meeting on Tuesday, House Republicans discussed stopgap measures, including a new idea gaining traction, a, quote, laddered, close quote, approach, which would fund parts of the government until early December and the rest until mid-January. Another proposal would simply extend all government funding until mid-January, according to those Republicans granted anonymity to discuss the private meeting. The Senate, meanwhile, is controlled by Democrats, is working to devise a more comprehensive spending plan that would fund the government at current levels while also considering President Joe Biden's nearly $106 billion request for supplemental money for Ukraine, Israel, the Asia-Pacific region, and border security. Congress is in this budget shutdown loop because the House and Senate failed, as they often do, to pass the dozen individual bills needed to fund the various agencies in the federal government. To complicate matters this time, Republicans refused Biden's request to support Ukraine in battling Russia unless the president agrees to their demands to beef up security along the U.S. border with Mexico. Biden's funding request seeks almost $14 billion in border funds for holding facilities, asylum officers, and other needs. Republicans say the funding doesn't go far enough, and instead they are demanding policy changes that would make it more difficult for immigrants to claim asylum at the border. They also want to revive building the border wall. From Ukraine, Zelensky pauses spring election. EU meets to consider membership options with some conditions. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky late Monday ruled out holding a presidential vote in the spring and urged his countrymen to avoid political divides, saying they must concentrate all resources on fighting Russia. Zelensky's comments in a video address follow increasing discussions about the possibility of a presidential election in March. Zelensky, who was elected for a 5-year term in March of 2019, previously avoided definitive statements on the question. His associates had said he was pondering various possibilities. Now, in wartime, when there are so many challenges, it is absolutely irresponsible to throw the topic of elections into society in a lighthearted and playful way, Zelensky said. I believe that now is not the right time for elections. Ukrainian legislation bans elections during martial law that has been in place since Russia launched its invasion in February 2022. The country would need to amend the law if it decided to hold the vote. Meanwhile, the European Union's executive arm was scheduled to meet Tuesday to finalize a decision on whether to recommend formally opening Ukraine's membership talks with expectations of a positive outcome for Kyiv, but with conditions attached. the European Commission will likely recommend that member states open formal negotiations upon the completion of reforms and legislation on minorities, anti-corruption, as well as deoligarchism and lobbying, according to people familiar with the matter and documents seen by Bloomberg. The Commission's opinion, which will be released on Wednesday, will need to be approved by member states when EU leaders meet in December for a summit. The move comes as the EU looks to inject impetus into its enlargement policy after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Moscow's attempts to destabilize Europe. The final wording of the opinion was yet to be finalized, said the people, who asked not to be identified. When Ukraine was granted a candidate status last June, the EU set out 7 steps that Kyiv needed to enact to move forward with the accession process. Ukraine has completed 4 of those milestones, but several actions in the other areas remain outstanding, the people said. Now we have an article entitled "Counsel in Hunter Biden Case Appears at Panel." He tells lawmakers he was the decision maker during rare testimony. The prosecutor overseeing the Hunter Biden investigation testified Tuesday that he had the ultimate authority in the years-long case as he made an unprecedented appearance before Congress to rebut Republicans' explosive claims that the probe was plagued with interference. David Weiss' interview with the House Judiciary Committee marked the first time a special counsel has testified to lawmakers in the middle of a probe. He agreed to the unusual appearance under heavy pressure from House Republicans who want to ramp up their impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden and his family. In his opening statement, Weiss told lawmakers he would not answer questions that could jeopardize the investigation and would only talk about the scope of his authority. "I am and have been the decision maker on this case," he told lawmakers. "I do not, however, make these decisions in a vacuum. No one at the Justice Department, including U.S. attorneys or the tax division, blocked or prevented him from pursuing charges or taking other necessary steps in the investigation," Weiss said. Looking at a digest of national and world news, we find an article entitled "House Votes to Censure Tlaib Over Her Rhetoric." The House voted late Tuesday to censure Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the only Palestinian American in Congress, an extraordinary rebuke of her rhetoric about the Israel-Hamas war. The 234-188 tally came after enough Democrats joined with Republicans to censure Tlaib, a punishment one step below expulsion from the House. The 3-term congresswoman has long been a target of criticism for her views on the decades-long conflict in the Middle East. The debate on the censure resolution on Tuesday afternoon was emotional and intense. Republican Representative Rich McCormick of Georgia pushed the censure measure. With other Democrats standing by her side, Tlaib defended her stance, saying she will not be silenced and I will not let you distort my words. And one other short blurb. After meeting with fellow GOP senators on Tuesday, Senator Tommy Tuberville, a Republican from Alabama, said he's open to negotiating an end to his blockade of almost 400 military nominees in protest of an abortion policy. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 8, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to the reading of The Messenger for November 8, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The front page today is full of election news and information. The first article is entitled, "Jail Bond Vote Fails to Pass. Measure received 55% yes votes, needed 60%. The $45.5 million bond referendum to build a facility to replace the aging and overcrowded Webster County Jail failed to pass by just 266 votes on Tuesday. Labeled Public Measure VS, the issue received 2,829 yes votes, or roughly 55% of the ballots cast. The measure needed to receive 60% yes votes to pass. Webster County Sheriff Luke Fleener acknowledged that it was a big ask from the county's voters. "We did our best to educate the voters, and clearly they're not ready to make that commitment," he said. "We'll keep doing our duties the best that we can." Fleener has been working with a West Des Moines consulting firm for the last 2.5 years to look into whether Webster County needs a new jail to replace the 40-year-old jail on the third floor of the Law Enforcement Center. The results of a jail study from the Samuels Group were clear. The current Webster County jail is not meeting the county's needs and is hemorrhaging taxpayer money. The current jail has a capacity of 56 inmates, but the county averages 75 to 90 inmates in custody at any given time. Fleener previously told The Messenger, "Because of this, Fleener has to rent space in other county jails to house Webster County's inmates, an expense costing taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars each year." In the last 5 years, the county has spent $1.5 million in housing and transportation costs for these overflow inmates. For the current fiscal year, external housing costs for inmates account for $350,000 of the Sheriff's Office budget. Fleener expects that number to increase to $400,000 for the next fiscal year. "I don't perceive the outsourcing of our inmates or costs going down. So at some point, the citizens will decide that they don't want to pay other counties," he said. "The unfortunate part is the costs aren't going to go away. We're still going to have to pay other people to house our inmates. At some point, we'll have to address it again." He noted that with the expense of housing inmates in other counties increasing year after year, it will begin to eat into the county's budget, and it will be the other county departments that suffer. "We would like to thank everyone who exercised their right to vote," Chairwoman Nikki Conrad said on behalf of the Webster County Board of Supervisors. "We'd also like to congratulate all of the candidates, not only who were elected, but also who ran for office." And now regarding council elections, Crimmins wins Ward 1 council seat. Jen Crimmins handily won the Ward 1 council seat Tuesday to replace retiring Councilman Terry Moenke. Crimmins won 63.56% of the vote, while Scott Davis won 36.44%, according to unofficial election results released Tuesday night. Crimmins won 293 votes, Davis won 168 votes. "I am honored," she said Tuesday night. "I'm very honored that my ward had the confidence in me to represent them." Crimmins will join Lydia Schur and Megan Secor on the council in January, marking the first time that there has been three women on the council. "I'm excited," Crimmins said. "I know Lydia well. I'm very excited about working with her. I don't know Megan that well, but I'm looking forward to working with her. I'm looking forward to working with everyone." Moenke opted not to seek re-election this year. He has served on the council for a decade. Nelson wins second term in Ward 2. Fort Dodge City Councilman Cameron Nelson won his second term representing Ward 2 in Tuesday's general election. Nelson won 231 votes, or 60.31%, while challenger Shannon Krause won 152 votes, or 39.69%. Nelson described himself as thankful, overwhelmed. He thanked Krause for running, especially since he said people putting themselves out there in our community have been lacking. "I think she definitely had a lot of drive and spirit," he said. Nelson credited his victory to the hard work I've done over the past 2 years. He said his priorities for a second 2-year term on the council will be law enforcement, the Corridor Plaza project, workforce, child care, and the Warden Plaza. And Secor wins at-large seat in a landslide. Councilwoman Megan Secor easily defeated Eugene Newsom Tuesday to win her first full term on the council. She won 2,200 votes, or 76.79%, according to unofficial election results released on Tuesday night. Newsom won 644 votes, or 22.48%. I'm so excited and grateful for the opportunity to continue to serve the people of Fort Dodge as a city council person, Secor said. Thank you to everyone who has supported me and helped me, whether through votes, guidance, or yard space, she added. Shout out to Eugene for stepping up and putting his name on the ballot. It takes a lot to put your name out there like that, and I have nothing but respect for him. I look forward to the next 4 years serving Fort Dodge, she added. Secor won a February 7 special election to complete the unexpired term of former Councilman Nevin Conrad, who resigned in October 2021 after being named the Humboldt County Magistrate. And we have three new members elected to the school board. Three new faces will be joining the Fort Dodge Community School District Board of Education this fall. On Tuesday, newcomers Brian Peterson, Emily Denklau, and Keenan Schur were elected to four-year terms on the board. Incumbent Diane Pratt was re-elected to another four-year term, and incumbent Dan Altman was elected to serve out the rest of the term for the seat he was appointed to fill when it was vacated in 2022. Peterson garnered the most votes with 1,845, or 15.81% of the vote. He was followed by Denklau with 1,822, 15.6%, Pratt with 1,774, 15.2%, and Schur with 1,748, or 14.98%. Incumbent Bill Kent finished just under 300 votes shy of being reelected, receiving 1,496 votes, or 12.82%. Other candidates were Allison Roderick with 9.36%, Sarah Sankey with 8.3%, Terry Townsend with 7.58%. There were 40 write-in votes. On page 2, an article entitled "The Supreme Court Seems Likely to Preserve a Gun Law That Protects Domestic Violence Victims." The Supreme Court seemed likely Tuesday to preserve a federal law that prohibits people under domestic violence restraining orders from having guns. In their first guns case since last year's expansion of gun rights, the justices suggested that they will reverse a ruling from an appeals court in New Orleans that struck down the 1994 ban on firearms for people under court order to stay away from their spouses or partners. The court's decision could affect other cases in which other gun laws have been called into question, including in the high-profile prosecution of Hunter Biden. President Joe Biden's son has been charged with buying a firearm while he was addicted to drugs, but his lawyers have indicated they will challenge the indictment. Liberal and conservative justices sounded persuaded by arguments from the Biden administration's top Supreme Court lawyer that the prohibition is in line with the long-standing practice of disarming dangerous people. The case before the court involves a Texas man, Zaki Rahimi, who was accused of hitting his girlfriend during an argument in a parking lot and later threatening to shoot her. The justices peppered Rahimi's lawyer, J. Matthew Wright, with skeptical questions that seemed to foretell the outcome. "You don't have any doubt that your client is a dangerous person, do you?" Chief Justice John Roberts asked Wright. When Wright said it depends on what Roberts means by dangerous, the Chief Justice shot back, "Well, it means someone who's shooting, you know, at people. That's a good start." Justice Brett Kavanaugh voiced concern that a ruling for Rahimi could also jeopardize the background check system that the Democratic administration said has stopped more than 75,000 gun sales in the past 25 years based on domestic violence protective orders. The Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans struck down the domestic violence law following the Supreme Court's Bruin decision in June of 2022. That high court ruling not only expanded Americans' gun rights under the Constitution, but also changed the way courts are supposed to evaluate restrictions on firearms. Justice Clarence Thomas' opinion for the court tossed out the balancing test judges had long used to decide whether gun laws were constitutional. Rather than consider whether a law enhances public safety, judges should only weigh whether it fits into the nation's history of gun regulation. Thomas wrote for the 6 conservative justices on the 9-member court. The Bruin decision has resulted in lower court rulings striking down more than a dozen laws. Those include age restrictions, bans on homemade ghost guns, which don't have serial numbers, and prohibitions on gun ownership for people convicted of nonviolent felonies or using illegal drugs. Justice Elena Kagan noted that there seems to be a fair bit of division and a fair bit of confusion about what Bruin means and what Bruin requires in the lower courts. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger, defending the domestic violence law, urged the justices to use this case to correct lower courts' profound misreading of the decision. It was unclear how far the high court would go in this case, and some of the justices sounded interested in a limited ruling that might leave open other challenges to the same law. "Do we need to get into any of that?" Justice Neil Gorsuch asked Preloger. In one more piece of election news, we find an article, Allstott Flattery Cruise to Re-election. Fort Dodge City Council members Kim Allstott and Dave Flattery were unopposed in Tuesday's general election. Flattery won 961 votes to win his 7th term representing Ward 3 in the northeast part of the city. He had served as an at-large member of the council from 2008 to 2011. Allstott won 881 votes while securing his 7th term representing Ward 4. That ward is the north-central part of the city. Council members elected to represent the wards serve 2 terms. Make that 2-year terms. The Messenger editorial today is entitled, "United Way of Greater Fort Dodge is Worthy of Support. Giving just a little can help a lot." Chances are just about everyone has heard of the United Way, and everyone has some perhaps vague idea that it helps people and relies heavily on donations to provide its services. Most recently, the United Way of Fort Dodge came to the attention of many when it stepped in to help those who were left homeless when a building at Westridge Townhomes was destroyed by fire. The community needs an organization that is able to step in and provide that kind of help. Crisis response is just a small part of what the local United Way does, however. Its top priorities are helping to prevent children from becoming homeless and assisting families that are poverty-stricken. The local United Way has these programs to help it accomplish those missions: Bridging the Gap and Beds for Kids, Homelessness Prevention, Wheels for Work, Basic Needs for Kids, Women's Support Network, Meals on Wheels, Hope for Healing, Senior Assistance Program, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. Those programs provide everything from food to beds. Providing those programs isn't cheap. United Way provides a means for everyone to chip in a little bit to help our neighbors who need some assistance. Donations can be made by signing up to donate via a payroll program offered by some local employers. Checks made out to the United Way of Greater Fort Dodge can be sent to 24 North 9th Street, Suite B, Fort Dodge, Iowa. Donations can be made online at www.unitedwayfd.org. All of the donated money stays here in Fort Dodge. Donating even just a little to the United Way can do a lot for families in need. We encourage everyone to donate. Also on the opinion page is an article by Froma Harap, Time to Face Political Truths on Immigration. While campaigning in New Hampshire, Nikki Haley was asked about the surge of migrants at the border. When I'm president, the former Republican governor of South Carolina said, we're going to stop catch and release, and we're going to start catch and deport. No president has put forth such a stern-sounding policy on illegal immigration since Democrat Barack Obama. His administration deported over 2.5 million undocumented entrants, concentrating on those who had committed crimes. Illegal immigration was lower under Obama than Donald Trump, who hid weak enforcement under nasty talk. Obama was dumped on by immigration advocates who called him deporter-in-chief. Latino activists occupied some of his campaign offices. But guess what? When it came time for re-election, Latinos turned out in record numbers to support Obama. His Hispanics were credited with handing him three swing states. So much for the political power of activists on this and other issues. Listen to Haley's views on immigration and you hear the usual things, some wrapped in vagueness. She said that undocumented immigrants should be divided between those working and paying taxes and those that are feeding off the system, she said. If they're feeding off the system, you send them back. Who can argue against sending back the freeloaders? But is she saying that people working illegally but paying taxes get a pass? Yes, possibly. But if so, she is not proposing anything that would stop unauthorized workers from getting jobs here in the first place. Jumbled messages enabled her to tell an audience in an Iowa farm town that she would alleviate the shortage of workers without getting specific. Trump didn't want to burden farmers with the need to check the legal status of their labor. Haley went after sanctuary cities, which nowadays is shooting fish in a barrel, that some cities wouldn't cooperate with the federal immigration authorities was reckless from the start. That current strain posed by the huge influx of asylum seekers has ended that kind of talk. And there's a reason in all this for President Joe Biden, a lesson in all of this for President Joe Biden. His policies aren't bad. He just suffers from the Democratic disease of not taking credit for things most of the public supports. Haley used the phrase catch and deport to distinguish from catch and release, a reference to the masses who cross the border, get themselves arrested, and put in a claim for asylum. If they get past that low bar, it may take years to hear their case. Most asylum claims are eventually rejected, but in the meantime, the applicants have settled in. Trump's famous COVID-era policy, Title 42, was, in effect, catch and release. It quickly turned back people at the border, but came with no consequences for trying to enter illegally. Anyone turned away could try again, and probably eventually succeed. Under Biden, anyone entering the country illegally would face a 5-year ban on reentry. That person could face deportation and possible criminal prosecution. Biden has also boosted enforcement at the border and now backs construction of more border wall in more heavily trafficked areas. The need now is to modernize the asylum program so it can quickly adjudicate claims. Thing is, you need two parties to fix it. And until just a few weeks ago, a collapsed Republican caucus couldn't get its act together to even elect a House Speaker. Candidates need to acknowledge these truths on immigration. The wave of immigrants seeking better lives in rich countries is happening across the world. The number of genuine claims for asylum may be rising as well. This country may need more workers, but there's no right to cheap labor. Truth number one is that the politics of it all are messy. And now we'll take a look at sports. First, an article entitled Hawks Reach Century Mark. Iowa had six players reach double figures as they cruised to a 110-68 victory over North Dakota in their season opener. The Hawkeyes, 1-0 overall, scored the most in a season opener under Fran McCaffrey, and the total was the sixth most under the veteran head coach. Iowa hit 12 three-pointers in the contest, 8 in the first half. Peyton Sanford led the Hawkeyes with 21 points and 9 rebounds. He was 7 for 13 from the field and he hit three triples. This was Sanford's 8th career 20-point game and his 11th career game with 3 or more three-pointers. Iowa's 4 freshmen combined for 31 points in their official Hawkeye debuts. Owen Freeman had 14 points in 15 minutes. Ben Cricky had 18 points on 8 of 13 shooting. DeSante Bowen had 12, while Patrick McCaffrey had 11. Patrick McCaffrey, 11, and Tony Perkins, 10, also reached double digits. The Hawkeyes out-rebounded North Dakota 44-38. Iowa has won 13 consecutive regular season openers under McCaffrey. He now has 262 career victories as Iowa's head coach, 10 wins from becoming the winningest coach in program history. The Hawkeyes have won 84 of its last 90 non-conference home games dating back to 2012. The Hawkeyes committed just one turnover in the first half and 7 for the contest. The Hawkeyes had a 27-3 advantage in fast break points. Iowa scored 31 points off 19 North Dakota turnovers. The Hawkeyes are back in action on Friday when they host South Alabama. And in local sports, we have an article entitled Bears Play for State Title Berth. Coming off back-to-back 3-win seasons, not many around the state likely pegged Bishop Garrigan to be one of 4 8-player football teams still standing. But here we are. The Golden Bears, 10-1 overall, will face top-ranked Winfield Mount Union, 11-0, here on Wednesday at 10 a.m. in the state semifinals inside the Unidome. The other contest sees Gladbrook Rhinebeck, 10-1, meet Bedford, 11-0, at 1 p.m. Bishop Garrigan has not lost since a 42-34 setback to St. Edmund in Week 1, rolling through its district before taking out the last 2 state champions in the postseason. Nobody thought we'd be here, BGHS head coach Marty Waddle said. Nobody outside these players and these coaches, and that's what this program is all about. Kids like this who defy the odds. We've taken on any and all challenges, regardless of the opponent. Now we have another big one standing in front of us. The Golden Bears have held 3 opponents to under 7 points and scored over 38 times, reaching 60-plus in 3 games. Caden Rothler, a senior, has rushed for 1,054 yards with 17 touchdowns, as sophomore Tate Forsch has thrown for 1,203 yards with 18 touchdowns and just 1 interception on 129 attempts. Forsch, a sophomore, also has 437 yards rushing and 10 scores, with classmate Ethan Marceau adding 7 TDs. Justin Bauer, Sam Plath, and Drew Lappi are all seniors with over 900 yards receiving between them. We've adjusted to 8-player and continue to adjust, Waddle said. We're still doing things that worked in the past. We've just got to adapt. Bishop Garrigan is making its 5th trip to the semifinals and first since 2016. They won it all in 1985 and have finished 2nd three other seasons, with this marking the 27th appearance in the playoffs all time, which ranks 17th in the state. Winfield Mount Union has seen quite the turnaround over the last 2 years, going 6-4 a season ago before putting together an unbeaten run to date this year. Prior to that, the Wolves had won just 11 games over a six-year span since going 10-1 in 2015. Jake Edwards leads the offense, completing 57% of his passes for 1,461 yards with 25 touchdowns and just 3 interceptions. Cam Buffington, who is headed to the University of Iowa, is the leading rusher with 1,326 yards and 23 scores, adding 564 yards receiving and 11 more TDs. Carter Lloyd has 366 yards receiving and 6 touchdowns, with Abram Edwards adding 312 and 5 touchdowns. Winfield Mount Union's defense has recorded 35 sacks, led by 11.5 from Edwards and 11 by Cooper Buffington. They have forced 21 turnovers and scored 3 defensive TDs, with 4 more touchdowns on special teams. After handling both Belle Plaine and Moravia in the playoffs, the Wolves knocked off perennial contender Don Bosco 34-29. This is the first time Winfield Mount Union has reached the Unidome since 1999. The semifinal winners will play Thursday, November 16th at 9:30 a.m.